to the Florida Roundup this week on WLRN. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
I heard gunshots. So when I tried to get up, I couldn't feel nothing like below my waist. So I thought everything got cut off or something. I thought I was over here and my leg was over there.
That's Aaron Willis. He was just 15 years old when he was shot. It left him without the use of his legs. He's 19 now and just started at FIU.
I just kind of said a little silent prayer to myself, like, you know, if this is it, I'm going out with the fight. So we wrestled into the hallway, and from there, he pistol whipped me in the head. So it, like, detached my eyebrow, but I didn't even know it was, like, that hard of a hit. He ended up shooting me, and he shot me in the chest.
That's Maya Passmore. She was just 16 years old when she was shot in her North Miami-Dade home. She's 30 years old now and runs her own public relations firm here in South Florida. These are just two of the hundreds of young people who have survived gun violence. WLRN News examined a decade's worth of data, finding almost 90% of children and teenagers with gunshot wounds rushed to the Ryder Trauma Center at Jackson Memorial Hospital survived. That's hundreds of young people and thousands of family members, friends, neighbors, classmates, and coworkers touched by gun violence in our community. We're reporting a series of stories this week and next week in our series, Young Survivors, The Unspoken Trauma of Gun Violence. This is where we begin the Florida Roundup this week. Have you or your family experienced gun violence? What has been the impact to your family, to your community? Join the conversation now. Gun violence in South Florida, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Look for us on Twitter and Facebook. You can also text WLRN to 63735 and join the conversation that way. Text WLRN to 63735. Sammy Mack, Nadej Green, and Roan Morgarity is the trio of reporters at WLRN that have reported our series, Young Survivors. Sammy, tell us about the survival rate you discovered, this 90% survival rate.
Right. So this data comes from the Ryder Trauma Center at Jackson Memorial Hospital here in Miami. And for the better part of the last decade, it was the only level one trauma center that would have received kids, specifically kids and teenagers who had gotten gunshot wounds. And based on what we saw there, there were more than 850 kids who were admitted to the trauma center for gunshot wounds. And their survival rate was about 90%. It was just a little under 90%, which was really surprising to us because, you know, we hear about shootings, we hear about kids who die. We don't hear as much about the survivors. And so we started asking, what does this experience mean?
We hear very little about their lives in the weeks and months and years after surviving a gunshot. How many people under 18 are admitted to the Ryder Trauma Center in any course of a given year with a gunshot wound?
It varies a little bit, and based on the data, it's not super easy to say, but it's a pretty even split over the past 10 years. And I will say, when you look at the numbers, there's definitely a spike when kids start turning about 14, so you're looking at high school age.
So that 14 to 18
that
is
14
a little
to 18
more.
Range, you see far more kids coming through the trauma center for gunshot wound injuries. That said, there are a lot of kids in that database who are, I mean, we saw numbers on that page that were in the zeros, kids who weren't even a year yet.
Nadej, tell us the story of Maya Passmore. How has the shooting affected her life as she was shot as a teenager and is now an adult?
So Maya is a Miami entrepreneur. She attended Miami Northwestern High School, and she was shot at home. Someone had broken into her home, and she ended up getting shot in the chest. She talked to me about what it was like, you know, looking back when she was 16 and how she handled it at school. And on the surface, it seems that she was fine, but she knew that, you know, she struggled with a lot of things emotionally. You know, the pressure of getting good grades and getting into college and just having survived a gunshot wound.
She's had, what, about 15 years?
Yes.
Since the incident. And is it still present?
Yeah, it's something that never leaves you. And she talks about that. I mean, not in the same way as, of course, when she immediately got shot or the first year after she got shot, but it's something that she lives with all the time. She talked about how maybe it informs how she reacts to people. She's very she's very private. She doesn't trust easily. And she just talked about all the different ways that she thinks that informed even who she is now as a go-getter, as, you know, doing what we call boss moves, right? She's an entrepreneur. She's very goal-driven. And part of that, she says, is because she didn't want to allow the fact that she had been victimized to somehow stop her trajectory in being a successful person.
She is one of the young survivors that we report on this week and next week here on WLRN. Join the conversation about gun violence and the youth in South Florida. 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. You can also join us via text by texting WLRN to 63735. Has gun violence touched you, your family, your friends, coworkers? Text WLRN to 63735. A story coming up next week is on three generations of people here in South Florida and gun violence. John Broughton is the third generation to have his life touched by guns.
In this environment, you go and learn this environment. Like, you can't throw me in China and expect me not to want to learn Chinese.
In spite of all the pain gunfire has caused him over the years, John says guns have always been alluring.
I ain't gonna lie, when you pull that trigger, it's just so, I don't know, you got a feeling, like, you just want to do it. I don't know. It's like a stress reliever. I first fired a gun when I was, 11 on the 4th of July. It was a sawed-off shotgun.
So set the scene for me. What's going on that an 11-year-old's getting a sawed-off shotgun?
4th of July.
Ron Morgarity reports that story. You'll hear it next week here on WLRN. He joins us now. Rowan, how has gun violence impacted John's life?
It's really been a constant from the time he was a toddler until now. He's 20. And just the parade of people in John's life who have either been shot or killed is staggering. His grandmother, his uncle, his half-brother. He's had friends, cousins, classmates get shot. And so, as you heard him say there, this has just been, you know, if you're in this environment, you're going to want to learn this environment. What he means by that is, that was in reference to focusing on school or sort of focusing on life in the street, protecting yourself, being safe, knowing what to do if you see something you're not supposed to see and things like that, which really consumed a lot of his childhood, I think.
He has moved in and out of the region here in South Florida, hasn't he, as his family has responded to this gun violence?
Yeah, so about 9 years ago, his mother decided to move to Jacksonville. And I don't think this was the only reason, but it was certainly a major factor, was the feeling that they needed to get out of Liberty City and just try and get some distance from all the violence that John had seen and that she worried that he might become wrapped up in. And so they've been back and forth. At one point, his mother told me something I found very poignant, which is, you know, I can't stop going to see my aunt who lives on 14th Avenue and 61st Street. So there's only so far away that I can get if I want to keep my world, my family, still connected. But so John is now in Jacksonville. He's driving a forklift. His grandfather's excited. He's got a girlfriend he thinks will help help him see a positive direction for his life and sort of continue to focus on other things that we hope all young people get to focus on.
Sammy, as you reported these survivor stories, how unique or commonplace did you find them?
It is so hard to know how many kids and teens and adults who have grown up with this have experienced the same things, but there were definitely things that we heard over and over again. So we know, based on some of the limited research that we have and from talking to people who work with these kids and from talking to the survivors themselves, that a lot of them are at risk of anxiety and depression and post-traumatic stress disorder and a lot of other mental health risks. But the part of the trouble with understanding what the survivor experience is that there just isn't a lot of research around it. And nobody's really tracking these kids in the long term. And we know sort of anecdotally that they can act out in school in ways that may not be obvious signs of trauma to somebody who isn't trained to look for them. And that can have effects elsewhere in their lives and, you know, within their families and their communities. So There are definitely common threads that we heard, for sure.
This survivability rate that you found, almost 90% of gunshot victims who are 18 years old or younger who make it to Ryder survive, was that readily available? Was it accessible? Was there a clearinghouse of information that that was being tracked?
That data is there, but you have to ask for it in the right way. So what we did is we talked to the folks at Jackson to see if this data existed, and it turns out that they do have kind of a data collection on their patients and some of their patient outcomes, but it requires somebody sitting down, going through it, going through some of the charts, and then coming back weeks to months later with the data that we had requested. And so it's different from, say, you know, cancer cluster monitoring that you see where there's a little bit more active looking for that. There's a little bit more active follow-up on some of those things. And the other piece of that is the Jackson data is a window on a moment. And it takes you through the moment of living, dying, right, and maybe getting discharged. But they can't follow up. They don't have the resources to follow up. How are you doing a year later? And looking at those kinds of outcomes.
And so, Nadej, when you talked to survivors and their families and wanted to talk about their experiences beyond that moment, how was that greeted?
Some people weren't ready to talk about it, didn't want to talk about it because it was too hard to talk about. You know, you're asking someone to revisit a very traumatic experience, and a lot of times they have not yet really come to terms with what had happened. So we reached out to a lot of people who just said, I can't talk about this. I don't want to talk about it. And the people we did talk to, I mean, even 30 years later, will tell you that, you know what, I wasn't okay, or here's how I wasn't okay at the time. Here's how this affected me 3 years later, 4 years later. I mean, I was out in the community. I spoke to one young man who didn't want to be interviewed, but he was shot 4 years ago. And the worst time for him is 4th of July and January 1st because of firecrackers. And he talks about, like, you know, in his neighborhood, he's tried to go to his neighbors and ask them, please do not fire firecrackers. And of course, they're going to still do it. But, you know, he spends all of his time on those days, like in his room with headphones on, trying to drown out firecrackers, because for him, that like revisits the time he got shot. And, you know, he reacts to it in a very negative way.
And Rowan, you spoke with a number of members of different institutions in the community that see the violence and the impact of the violence sometimes days, weeks, or months later. How did they encounter you as you were trying to move beyond that moment of life and death and discuss the impact that moment has had later on in their lives?
Well, what's interesting from the perspective of, you mentioned institutions, there's not some mechanism that ensures that everybody in your life finds out you've been through something terrible. And so I think one of the challenges that people face in schools, say, is knowing when you have to sort of flag a student's behavior as being, oh, maybe something's going on here, or having the bandwidth or the time to check in and having the basis in that relationship that you're going to get a straight answer. And so the sense I got from talking to people like John is that it's not something you necessarily want to open up about. It takes a lot to try and revisit, you know, the trauma from a shooting or losing a loved one or something like that. And so it's difficult. You have to sort of become numb in some cases in order to get on with things, in order to have the space and the mental energy to deal with the rest of your life. And so people kind of shut it down in some cases.
LaKayla Limas is one of those who experienced gun violence in her community. She had four of her friends shot and killed during her last 2 years at Miami Northwestern Senior High School. There were four separate shootings involved here, and all of them were outside of school.
It made me work harder, I can say, because I was like, most of them didn't get a chance to walk across the stage, didn't get the chance to graduate high school, give their mother that satisfaction, you know. On that day of graduation, it was me and them.
One person's experience with gun violence here in South Florida. What's yours? 800-743-9576. Is it just something you read about in the headlines or see or hear about? 800-743-WLRN. Send us a text, WLRN at 63735. That's another way to join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup this week. Text WLRN to 63735. Nadej, you spoke with LaKayla. How did she deal with this kind of violence at such a pivotal moment in her life?
LaKayla was one of the more surprising interviews for me because I think oftentimes when we're talking about youth gun violence, even among survivors, you're talking about the direct victim, the person who was shot. LaKayla was never shot, but she is a survivor because four of her friends were killed, because she lives in a neighborhood where, you know, she knows and her sister know and her brothers know if you hear gunshots, duck low. Like, that's what you do. And then you get up. Like, this is part of their regular, this is how they live, right? And so they create these workarounds. So as a survivor of gun violence, it means surviving your friends who are teenagers. And interestingly enough, her 16-year-old friend who was killed, there were, I think a crisis intervention team did come out to the school, mm-hmm. or there was, you know, someone spoke to the class, but they only spoke to his class, the freshman class.
Just the class that the victim was in.
Right. But she wasn't in his class. And she was impacted, deeply impacted by his death. So it just goes to show the ripples that exist, that it's not just the classmates. It's the kids who grew up with you. It's the kids who walk the hallways with you. A freshman might get shot, but that could very well impact the senior if they hang out together, if they live on the same block. And so her experience, she talked about not handling it well. And even though she knew there were therapists on staff at school, there were counselors available to her, she did not avail herself to that at 16, 17 years old because she didn't want to talk to a stranger. Now, looking back, she says, I really wish I did, because the way I handled it, it was literally tearing me apart on the inside.
Sammy, what do we know about the impact of this kind of gun violence? Longitudinal, there's a scientific term for you, through the course
the long-term studies,
through the course of years.
Over years, not much.
And why not?
The short answer. So 20 years ago, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, used to have a division that looked at gun-related injuries and did research around that. But around that time, there was a dust-up with some Republican lawmakers at the federal level and some support from the National Rifle Association. And ultimately, what ended up happening was something called the Dickey Amendment, where this congressman from Arkansas, who was sitting on one of the, you know, one of the groups that decides budgets for mm-hmm. various agencies, basically wrote out all funding for gun-related injuries at the CDC and made it very specific that the CDC could not engage in advocacy or gun control, which is not what the CDC had really been doing, but it sent a really clear message that there would not be funds and resources available for this.
You spoke with him
recently
for this series, and now that, 20 years has passed since mm-hmm. that debate, what does he think about the amendment that has his name attached to it?
There is some remorse there. And part of what he says now is that looking back on it, he didn't realize that you could research this stuff and not be in an advocacy position. And on the researcher's side, I also talked to the guy who was in charge of that division of the CDC, a guy named Dr. Mark Rosenberg, who said that he should have been saying from the beginning, like, we don't want to take guns away from Americans, which is basically what the other side was hearing in that sort of lost translation between scientists and politicians.
But even now, it's even a much more, certainly in Florida, it's even a much more hyper-political environment when talking about gunshot victims or gunshot survivors and trying to provide government funding for medical research, scientific research into situational causes or survivability from a medical side, and also the survivability from an emotional side. It gets wrapped up in a Second Amendment.
It does very, very quickly. And that is one of the obstacles for people who would like to know more about what happens to these kids. I talked to one trauma surgeon who told me she had been told point blank that that looking into what happens to kids after they get shot was like a career killer because it's gun research. And so, you know, that has had real ramifications for understanding the experience of these survivors and what they need. And so that is an ongoing conversation. There have been some attempts to refund the research. There have been some attempts to change the amendment, but so far nothing, there has not been common ground enough to change what had happened 20 years ago.
The gun debate, the data around survivability for 18-year-old and younger gunshot victims in Miami-Dade County, and the voices. It is our Young Survivor Series, the unspoken trauma of gun violence. Sammy Mack, Nadege Green, and Rowan Moore Garrity are along with us. Your phone calls up next. Line them up, 800-743-9576. Have you been impacted by gun violence here in South Florida or elsewhere? What's been that impact? 800-743-9576. More after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. A WLRN News investigation found 88% of people 18 years or younger who were shot in the past decade and made it to Ryder Trauma Center at Jackson Memorial Hospital survived. That's hundreds of children and teenagers who are still living with their wounds, real and emotional, years after being shot. You can hear these stories in our series, Young Survivors, the Unspoken Trauma of Gun Violence. Reports began this week. They continue next week here on the radio. The entire series is at WLRN.org/Young Survivors. And we have a special hour coming up next week on Wednesday at 11 a.m. and 8 p.m. for our Young Survivors, the Unspoken Trauma of Gun Violence. Sammy Mack, Nadege Green, and Rowan Moore Garrity make up the reporting team behind this effort. You can join the conversation today. Have you been touched? Has your family been touched by gun violence? Are you a survivor yourself? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us, text WLRN to 63735. Text WLRN 63735 to join that conversation. Claudia is first up in Miramar. Claudia, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thank you for your phone call.
Thank you for having me.
What's your experience?
Well, I was listening. I've been compelled to call because I've been listening in for a few days now. I'm a big fan of WLRN, by the way. I've been listening because I am a victim of a drive-by shooting. I was shot in 1994. So I'm a survivor. Listening to your program, I could relate to a lot of the young survivors because being shot is not something that you get over that easily. It's an emotional, it's very emotional. Within you, your body may heal, but inside of you, many, many years, especially your scars on the outside, people will look at you and say, you know, like, well, what happened to her? You know, but inside you feel you feel so different that you're being looked at, you know, differently. I do have to thank Jackson Memorial because I was airlisted to Jackson, and I have to thank them because they saved my life.
Claudia, how old were you when you became a victim of a gunshot?
At the time, I was 22.
And
I am now 46.
And did you find the resources that you needed, your family needed?
To be honest with you, the resources was not really there because they had a victims assistance program, which you do several reconstructive surgeries, but funding wasn't there for, 'cause right now I'm living with issues because I had gotten shot in my face where it broke, the bullet entered through the palate that holds my teeth, which were knocked out, and broke my jaw. So I looked, I didn't look like everyone else. I commend Jackson because they did a good job with, you know, patching me up. I did several reconstructive surgeries, but the funding was not there, you know, to go more deeper, to replace teeth, you know, and to implant. It just wasn't there.
And when you came home, Claudia, what do you wish had been there? What sort of supports would have made this easier for you?
Honestly, I felt alone. My family was there, you know, as much as they could be, which was my mother and my siblings at the time. But it was a very lonely place as far as, like, counseling. There was not really any counseling, you know, back then at that time. Maybe they have it now. You know, how do you adjust yourself after being a victim? You know, people look at you differently. You know, you as an individual, for me anyway, it made me stronger. It propelled me to work three different jobs at a time. Mm-hmm. And to the point now where me and my husband, we run our own business. So it for me personally, it was like it sent me into overdrive, because it made me look at my life differently, you know, saying, you know, I have to go and do more. You know, I could have not been here, and I want to get certain things done.
Claudia, we're glad you're with us, and thank you for sharing your story with us today on the Florida Roundup. We appreciate it.
Thank you for taking my call.
Claudia in Miramar there. I want to take another call from Fort Lauderdale. Gilbert is on line four. Gilbert, welcome to the program. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yes, good afternoon. First of all, real quick, to all of those who have been shot, you know, tough situation. I've been there. I was around during the McDuffie riots. I was 16 years old, lived in Overtown, the swamp. I'm a white Caucasian male, 52 now. But this was a time when the guns were not even that good. Nowadays, you have these incredible weapons that are a lot more accurate, but to those that have been shot, the experience of seeing my friends, many of them get shot, it's difficult. And as far as the support system, like there's nothing else. There wasn't anything available. They physically patched you up and you were out on your way. And, you know, it was a way of life. I was telling the interviewer when I first got on the phone, you know, I was watching TV. I was 12, 14 years old. Gunshots are ringing in the backyard. All you do is duck your head and keep watching TV, and hopefully a bullet doesn't come flying through your window. So, interesting discussion you guys are having, and I don't know what can be done with it. A lot of people go through it, and the sadness is, myself, I'm doing fine. It did not affect me that traumatic-wise. I thought it was just a way of life, and you don't have anything to compare it to at that time. So the kids nowadays have nothing to compare it to. You know, who knows a $5 room in a hotel if you don't get a chance to stay in one? So it's a difficult situation that all these people are going through. That's a quick summary of what happened to me.
Gilbert, thank you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Rowan Moore-Garrity, I want to ask you about some of the institutional efforts that are involved here, especially when it comes to the schools. As we've reported, and you've heard even from one of the calls there, oftentimes these survivors wind up back in our local institutions, including the schools, and the schools have to be equipped to deal with both the survivors themselves as well as the ripple effect. What did you find when you spoke to some of those folks that are dealing with this?
So the first order response is something Nadej mentioned, which is the crisis team. So after a tragedy, and it wouldn't have to be a gunshot injury or death, but you know, if someone dies by illness or whatever, the district has a crisis team made up of school psychologists who will go out to a school site if a principal asks for help, and spend a couple days trying to figure out what comes next, what kind of resources are needed. The thing about that, though, is one, they need to know about it and they need to be asked to come. That doesn't always happen. Sammy mentioned the challenge of getting good data on this, and sort of communication isn't always there. And so non-fatal shootings don't actually spur an intervention by that crisis team all that often. We looked at their records for the past year and found basically two off-campus shootings that prompted them to visit the school where students had been affected, and one instance where bullets had pierced the wall of a classroom where they in an elementary school. Thankfully, no one was hurt, and they went and talked. And the other thing about them is they are there for a couple days. And so after that couple days is over, any kind of psychological or emotional support that students might need is going to have to come from the staff on campus who can be very committed and very devoted and very hardworking, but there aren't a lot of them. So a typical ratio for a school counselor would be about one counselor for 500 students. Mm. And they are providing psychological and emotional support really alongside this whole long list of administrative tasks, like tracking grades and credits and making sure kids get registered for summer school on time, working with homeless students, all kinds of things. So people are really stretched.
And to add to Rowan's point, the district says, for the most part, they have to be invited in order to come in. But there are principals who don't want them there. I talked to Steve Gallen, who is now a school board member, but he talked to me about his experience as a principal. He was principal at Miami Northwestern when Maya was in school there. And he said he never called the crisis intervention team. He knew that they were there, a resource, but he didn't find them to be effective because he called them a revolving door. And especially in schools where you have multiple incidents where shootings may happen, and there are a few schools that have seen a number of their kids shot, he was like, it's not enough to just show up, you know, maybe talk to the kids for 1, 2, 3 days and leave. He was like, because these kids need someone that they can trust, that they can open up to, and that this is long term. And he addressed that this isn't just something that happens in a vacuum today. And, you know, this was like a car accident. It was like, you know, everyone was, you know, shocked and then you moved on. He was like, this is something that the kids were experiencing over time. And so there wasn't that overtime structure in place at the schools to really deal with this, someone that the kids can consistently go to and have a relationship with. Because even in the course of reporting this series, people didn't want to talk to us because we were strangers. We were just showing up. And so he was very adamant about that point when I spoke with him, and it didn't make it into all of our stories, but he didn't call them. He didn't find them to be effective.
It's all part of our series, Young Survivors, the Unspoken Trauma of Gun Violence, here on WLRN. 800-743-9576 is the telephone number. Stephen from Pembroke Pines has been hanging on here. Stephen, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hello. Yes, I have a long history of being involved with the first being drafted in 67. I was in Vietnam in the jungles in a light infantry unit. And I want to touch upon something very quickly. The young man who called up earlier, he said he was firing a shotgun during 4th of July at 11 years old, and he felt so vicarious. He had vicarious thrills upon the sound effects and so forth. Well, when I was on a fire base in Vietnam in 68, we were mostly in the jungle. We went up to fire bases, and we went up once in 4th of July, and the sky was lit with, it was unprecedented. I've never seen such a splash of noise and weaponry fired in the valley below. The difference is, we had to go out the next day. We saw the bodies, the brains all over the place, and the various things that I hope no one in your audience has to live through. There's your difference. We've become out of touch with reality, more and more reality and fantasy, wider apart, and there's a deep, deep denial on the left and the right in this country concerning, there's sort of like a denial. They don't want to face these realities. At the same time, we talk a good talk, but we don't actually deal with traumas and violence. And
Steve,
that's very tragic. And one more thing.
Go ahead.
One thing. We made a major blunder after the Vietnam War. We didn't properly heal our nation. That's all I want to finish up with. We have not yet really healed the nation regarding that war.
Stephen?
All right, I'll leave it to you, people.
We appreciate your service in the armed forces there. Stephen from Pembroke Pines joins us here on WLRN. Finally, Guillermo in Hialeah. Guillermo, go ahead. Welcome to the program. Your thoughts.
Good afternoon. This is Guillermo from Hialeah. I wanted to also add to this the idea that trauma happens also on the side of the victim who is forced to defend themselves from gun violence, and then you end up, unfortunately, it results in the death of both of the perpetrators.
Guillermo, what do you mean by the victim who's forced to defend himself? You mean somebody who does the shooting?
No, meaning you're a victim, you're attacked, but you happen to be armed. So you have time to react, you defend yourself against the attackers that are armed, and you effectively defend yourself. That in itself has a whole other level of trauma, emotional and psychological trauma afterwards.
That probably is the case. But most of the kids that we talk to for this series have been shot in drive-by shootings, have been shot after someone has broken into their home. And so that was the focus really on this series were kids who were shot in those ways. But I could see that as well.
Sure. Guillermo, do you have...
I'll jump in here and say...
Go ahead, Rowan.
John's grandfather described to me talking with his grandson and sort of warning him to stay away from a life that would involve guns and saying, you know, I spent 11 years in prison, and in prison I was with a lot of shooters. And let me tell you, at night they see the people that they hurt. So I can imagine that this creates ripple effects in perpetrators. Nadej talked to Morris Copeland, who said, who runs a unit that deals with kids who've been arrested, the Jack, and he said the victims often do become the perpetrators, and the perpetrators often become the victims. So there is there's trauma on all sides of this.
Guillermo, thank you for bringing that up. We appreciate that here on the Roundup.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. Nadej, Rowan mentioned you spoke with Morris Copeland. He's the director of the Miami-Dade County Juvenile Services. This is the law enforcement, the judicial portion here. What role does it play with young survivors?
So it's interesting because juvenile services oversees juvenile services, but the Juvenile Assessment Center is where kids who get arrested go. And over the years, Miami-Dade has made a really intentional effort to steer more towards intervention and not detention. And so most of the kids who actually go through juvenile assessment are not detained. They're referred to counseling, they're referred to substance abuse treatment. You know, they'll figure out what is going on with this child and figure out what is the best means. And some of them are detained. When I spoke with Morris Copeland, who's the director, he talked about seeing kids who have been victims long before they ever get there. And he was also like, this is an adult problem. We like to talk about these kids, like, you know, whether or not they were innocent victims or not innocent victims.
What does he mean by that, do you think?
He's like, this is an adult problem. In the communities where they get the guns from tend to be adults. And also the people who can solve this are adults. And so it's a lot easier to talk about whether or not a kid is good or bad. It's a lot harder to talk about the root causes that got them to where they are. So what does the education system look like where this kid is from? What does their family structure look like where this kid is from? On the block that he lives on, what does that look like? What is this kid's lived experience before they come to interact with juvenile assessment? And those are the harder issues to deal with. It's a lot easier to say, you know, this kid did something. And he talked about sitting down with some of these young men and hearing their stories and hearing their trauma. And he comes from a unique perspective because he's from this community. Mm-hmm. Morris Copeland is from Liberty City, grew up around Lincoln Field Project. So he has these firsthand experiences himself. And so that was a really, during our interview, he was very adamant that, you know, adults, this is an adult problem.
He emphasized to you that he empathizes with the young people that he deals with in the juvenile system.
When you're out here doing this work with these young men, mostly young men of color, do you see yourself in them?
Every day. That's why I can never turn my back on any of them. I can never sit in judgment of them. I can never underestimate their pain. I can't do that.
Nadej, what do you think he meant by never underestimating their pain?
Because he sat down and talked one-on-one with these young men, and he knows their stories. He knows their stories personally. He knows where they come from. He knows what has happened to them. So that's what he means by not being able to underestimate their pain, because he hears their pain. And in fact, one of the interesting things he talked to me about is they actually survey the young men when they come in through juvenile assessment, like, what do they want to be? The top two things were either athletes or law enforcement officers / working for fire departments. So he was like, this is what they want to do. They want to be in law enforcement. And so he's like, so how do we get it so that they can actually reach their dreams and not end up in the system? And so all of that informs his perspective when he talks about knowing their pain, because he understands that some of them can't reach that goal. They won't be able to if they don't turn around.
One of the stories that you can hear in our Young Survivors series, The Unspoken Trauma of Gun Violence, it has been happening all of this week, and it continues next week here on the radio. You can find all the reports at WLRN.org/youngsurvivors. You can also catch a special hour of the program on Wednesday next week at 11 a.m. and 8 p.m. It is Young Survivors, the Unspoken Trauma of Gun Violence, a WLRN news special, Wednesday, 11 a.m. and 8 p.m., reported by the team of Sammy Mack, Nadege Green, and Rowan Moore Garrity. To the three of you, thank you so much for the work.
Thanks for having us.
Still to come on our program, we'll end on a lighter note for the roundup, the Oscar spotlight on Miami and Moonlight. That's next as the roundup continues.